Welcome to A Moment of Bach. Or is it?
Or is it?
Where we usually take our favorite moments from J.S. Bach's vast musical output, just a minute's worth or even a few seconds, and show you why we think they are remarkable. And today, we take a slight detour from our normal format and give you a moment of Vivaldi. We are your hosts, Alex and Christian Giebert. Today's moment comes from an older video from the Netherlands Bach Society, a performance of Winter from the Four Seasons by Antonio Vivaldi.
Shivering, frozen mid the frosty snow and biting, stinging winds, running to and fro to stamp one's icy feet, teeth chattering in the bitter chill. These words go with Vivaldi's first movement of the Winter Concerto, which itself is part of a suite called The Four Seasons, probably his most famous work. Listeners, you might be wondering, why are we doing a moment of Vivaldi today instead of a moment of Bach? Bach did love Vivaldi. We have covered a transcription that Bach did of Vivaldi, but the reason is because the Netherlands Bach Society, whose music we play on this podcast and whose recordings we use, has recorded this. But it's not just that they have a recording of this. They have a, magical performance of this, a live performance that was captured. It's one of the first things on their YouTube before the bulk of the Bach stuff, actually. So although they are a Bach society, they do occasionally perform works of other Baroque contemporaries. And so it's this particular performance by Shunsuke Sato and the Netherlands Bach Society that I'm interested in. If you've heard this before, if you've heard Vivaldi's Winter before, you may not have heard it like this. Because in this performance, would you say, Alex, there's just a lot of color and timbre that we don't normally hear in a Baroque ensemble?
Yeah, it's every choice that they make is an interesting choice in the interpretation of this piece.
Mm-hmm. The sheer contrast between the opening trembling from the cold and the icy snow to the flurry of the next part, the loud part, just the dynamic contrast is really good in this performance. And there's some tempo things done here that you don't normally see. Usually you hear a performance of this more or less in one speed. But here we have a couple of tempo changes throughout, which is really delightfully unexpected. But the main event is to talk about the violin solo and the subtle or bold things that he does with it. The reason why you might take such an extreme approach to playing a solo like this is because this is what we might call program music or programmatic music. It's kind of worth saying that not everybody in the early modern world really thought that music could just directly represent something.
Yeah.
That is a strange thing to talk about, because now we know very obviously that music can sound a certain way and unlock certain emotions. But can music evoke an icy winter? Yes, it absolutely can, but at that time it probably would have been seen as a little bit more of an experiment. As we got into the 1800s with tone poems and romantic composers, this kind of thing was like a dime a dozen. But in the Baroque period, 100 or 150 years earlier, it was pretty rare. And this is one of the earliest instances of it, because there's no words. So you could say opera is always, about something. It kind of seems like it'd be harder to write a piece of music that was about nothing, right? You could just call it Symphony Number 1, and it would just be purely absolute music. We'd call that absolute music. And for some composers, they felt like that was a higher calling.
Mm-hmm.
Especially there was a debate about this in the Romantic era between Brahms and Wagner. But program music, programmatic music, it absolutely works. It's a subjective thing to say, like, does this really sound like winter? Does the other one really sound like spring? And so on. That's too subjective to judge. But I think most people agree that it does. But the performance really is really what sells it. If you played all these the same, this wouldn't sound like winter, I would say.
Yeah, so you map the, if you know what the piece is supposed to be about, then you map that onto your experience of it, right? If you listened to this and didn't know what it was called, would you get that feeling of winter from it? I don't know, maybe.
Maybe, yeah, that's not a good question. That kind of seems like the ultimate test, doesn't it? Like,
yeah, it's like the Turing test of program music.
Yeah.
Can it stand on its own, right? I wonder that too, but then also, like, to your point about the performance, of course, what the program of the piece is going to influence the performance choices by the performing group. But that's why this one is so remarkable, because this is one of the most, it's not just one of the best performances I've ever seen of this piece, of winter specifically, but it's the most programmatic.
It's the most wintry.
Yeah. It's the most teeth chattery. It's the most snowy. It just sounds cold. But then again, like you said, that is subjective. And that's the subjectivity of it is the reason why a lot of composers thought of it as a lesser form, program music, I mean, in general, rather than absolute music, which sometimes they would consider as a higher art form.
Yeah, until it became the opposite challenge to try to make something, to try to express a non-musical idea with music to the extreme where it would be as obvious as possible, like with Wagner or Strauss.
Yeah.
The degree to which that actually worked is, I think, the subjective part. I think it's a lot easier to say that Vivaldi's Winter sounds cold than it is to say, like, any given Strauss piece sounds like what it's trying to represent.
Yeah, I mean, and music doesn't have to try to represent something to represent something to you either. I mean, it's all very vague. It all depends on the person. But I make the argument, and I think that Leonard Bernstein has this similar argument in one of his books, which is that all music is a metaphor for something for each person. It's not like you have to always zero in exactly on what the composer wanted that piece to be about, but all tension in music is a metaphor for tension in life. All resolution after the tension in music is a metaphor for those times of our lives when that happens and we find a moment of peace. Major and minor feel the way they do because we've been sort of trained to think of them in those ways, and they've been associated with happy and sad, respectively. And major, in a more objective way, major is a purer sound that is more indicative of the actual overtone series of nature. So, of course, it sounds a little more consonant. So, like, all these things factor in, you know?
Well, that's actually two things, right? Because one thing is that culture, what we grow up with hearing is what we not just like, but understand. And understand to represent things like musicologists and ethnomusicologists and anthropologists have played music samples to communities around the world that have absolutely no experience with Western music. Mm-hmm. And for them, like Elvis or rock and roll was like pretty digestible, but Beethoven was just completely incomprehensible to them, which is, it's kind of a funny thing to think about. I mean, Beethoven can kind of be incomprehensible to us too, but
yeah.
But then the other thing, so one thing is culture, and then the other thing is acoustics, you were saying. Like, there's right. also a reality of acoustics where certain things are more consonant and harmonious than others, and music does take advantage of that, but it's both. And it's hard to say, it's hard to say that it's science. Well, even if you try to use the acoustic angle, it doesn't always work. There are just things that we do in music that we represent things because it's just tradition. It's such a tangled mess. It's not possible to unravel. But that's why a performance like this is so successful, is because it goes as far as it can to represent the thing that it's clearly supposed to programmatically represent.
Yeah, and more successful than something as subjective as major and minor and like dynamics and tension and resolution, all things that you mentioned, Christian, you have to be sort of be brought up to understand what those feel like. Really, more objective than that is just like, you know what sounds crisp and cold? Something that sounds like this, you know? Dun, dun, dun. Like, yeah. Of course that sounds crisp and cold. That's just exactly, it feels like a little shiver, you know?
Yeah. Feels like
teeth chattering.
Yeah. But on the other hand, maybe the effects and the sounds that we're hearing out of the solo violin are sort of like ice. You know how ice has a sound, like when you step on it, or snow, the dry crunch, or the creak of ice.
Mm-hmm.
Those things all have objective physical sounds, and we are subconsciously just led there. The performers just kind of know that if you do this particular overtone series on the violin and you bow it just this way, it will be like stepping on sludgy snow.
Sure.
So how does solo violinist Shunsuke Saito achieve this? In other words, like, what is he doing musically? And that brings me to my favorite moment, the moment of, I almost said Bach, the moment of Vivaldi for today, which is right near the beginning. We have a slow introduction. I guess I wouldn't say slow. It is marked allegro non molto, so not too cheery, I guess. We already have a little bit of icy coldness. And then the solo really opens up with the chilling wind.
Yeah. And by the way, you mentioning that being the chilling wind there is not talking about programmatic music. You're not just feeling that about what he's doing. That is literally what Vivaldi wants that to be, because he writes that in to the score.
It's just
something
right
that's... Yeah, that's something that's remarkable about this. Not just that he wrote programmatic music at all, but that he wrote these little sonnets, these little Italian pieces of Italian poetry, and they were meant to accompany the score, and he wrote specific lines of them into the music on the page. So this part that you're mentioning that he plays on the solo violin with the fast stuff right there, that is supposed to be the breath of the... Or that is supposed to be the wind, right?
Severe, this, it looks like.
Severe wind.
Yeah.
Horrible wind. Yeah.
Blowing the severe horrible
cold.
Wind.
Yeah.
Which, there's a lot of different translations, but stinging winds is one of them. And so this is an impressive moment right here in general in any performance of Vivaldi's Winter first movement. We're talking only about the first movement right now. There are three, but this is the first. It's what he does, what Saito does with the last note that I think is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
You usually trill that last note. He employs a timbre effect that has to do with the area you bow in. So if you imagine a violin playing in an ordinary fashion, there's that bridge, and then there's the fingerboard, and in between that is the empty space where you bow. But if you place the bow a little bit closer to your fingers or a little bit closer to the bridge, you get a different sound, to put it simply. But to put it a little bit more accurately, you get different overtones, and the violin truly sounds different. It's a little bit hollow and fluty if you play it close to your fingers. That's called sul tasto. And if you play it really close to the bridge, it gets, I guess you might describe it as, colder and drier, maybe? It's called sul ponticello, on the bridge. This is what he's doing here, sul ponticello. But he's kind of doing a extreme sul ponticello, because if the orchestra is marked sul ponticello in a piece of music for strings, it won't be as extreme as this. This is like, he's playing right up against that, and maybe it has to do with the fact that this is a Baroque violin that could accentuate this effect a little bit. But take another listen to what he does here, and he does it two times, but the first one is the one that just winds up being the most interesting to me, because let's listen to that.
It's a harmonic, isn't it?
Well,
because the note is C.
Yeah.
On the page, and what I'm hear, we hear is a G and A flat trill.
Yeah, so what's happening here,
we hear the low C first, a little bit, if you listen closely. Yeah, you hear the low C,
yeah,
and then into a trill, a high G and A flat trill.
The note is C, with a trill on it.
But it's... He's playing this.
But he's not playing that.
Well, it's a harmonic, right?
Well, no, it's...
Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, we are hearing harmonic. Yeah. He's also not playing a violin harmonic, if that makes sense.
Oh, I see what the distinction. Yeah. Yeah.
He's on the violin or other string instruments. If you purposefully play in a certain way with another finger, you can achieve an artificial harmonic, like two octaves higher than what it would sound like if your other finger wasn't on the violin. That's another hollow sound that's a lot like this one. That technique is called playing a harmonic. But to be very specific about what we're talking about here, he's not doing that. He's playing like extreme sul ponticello. And the result is a violin sound, a timbre, that has such a strong harmonic of the 12th above the interval of a 12th above the note that we hear it more than anything else, even the fundamental note. Yeah, because what's happening here is actually quite neatly scientific and acoustic. You have a C, he's playing a C, but as is the case in all real instruments, when you play a C, you get overtones with that C because the string vibrates not only its full length, but also half its length, giving you an octave above the C in a very light volume. And then the next one is a third of the string, which is a fifth above in music. I mean, one third of the length of the string, which produces the interval of an octave and a perfect fifth above the fundamental note. So these are all happening every time anyone plays any note, but we don't hear them because instead we just hear that instrument's particular identity. That is what makes instruments sound like themselves.
Yeah, or voices.
Or even. Voices, vowels of a voice. This is what makes a clarinet sound different from a trumpet, an ooh sound different from an ah, and everything. This is what makes instruments sound different in the most basic sense as far as like prolonged tones are concerned. So when he does this, he is playing the C and trilling the D flat. He's doing that, but the high stuff that comes out is a result of the fact that he chose to bow in a weird place. Kind of like if you stick your finger in a piano, you'll get some... on the string that's playing, you'll get some weird overtones as well. Although I guess that would be more like a harmonic, like a true harmonic.
There it is.
So that's what happens if I touch the piano string a third of the way down when I play it. So there must be some other, a little bit slightly more complicated math going on with what he's doing, because he's bowing much closer to the bridge than a third away from the bridge, so it's probably like a multiple of three or something.
Mm.
That's something for like a physicist to work out. It's beyond our pay grade. But so this entire movement and the whole suite, the whole especially Winter, is full of those effects. So if you live in a part of the world where it's winter right now and it's still cold, which is, I guess, not true of us at all, just on a sunny bike ride, but then you can give this whole thing a listen. I think it would put you in the mood. Ooh, I guess you'd be sick of winter right now if you lived in a cold place, wouldn't you? You'd be
March 19th for us in the U.S. So actually, when this drops, is the last day of winter. March 19th is spring.
Oh, got it in just in time.
Yeah. And now, here is that first violin solo moment from the first movement of Winter from the Four Seasons by Antonio Vivaldi. If this introduction to a musical moment has inspired you to hear the rest of this production of Winter by the Netherlands Bach Society, please see the link in the episode description. Do you want to hear our new episodes as we release them? I bet most of you who are faithful listeners of A Moment of Bach have figured out that you can hit subscribe on your podcast player, and then the episodes will download automatically. So, for any of you who don't do that, do that.
So we will make our return back to Bach with...
It will be Holy Week next week. So we will return to the St. Matthew Passion for the closing chorale movement of the first part of that large work. Famous chorale movement, O Mensch Bewein, Dein Sünde Groß. And we will look at a moment right near the end of that movement, something that has charmed me for many years.
Until next time, when we return to our Bach moments, enjoy this other moment.